Hey, welcome. Welcome, yeah, Jeannie.
Thank you.
Hey, this is kind of fun. New experience for Jeannie.
Oh.
New experience for me to teach with Jeannie. Jeannie Shermer is one of our leaders here, and she's a small group coach. She's also a VBI teacher. And I love Jeannie's kind of knowledge of the Bible and some of the characters that we're taking a look at their lives. She's taught extensively on, and so I don't know how I got her to do this, but I got her to come up here with me tonight. And she's kind of peeing her pants right
yes,
now.
I am, sorry. Actually.
She's also a teacher at Hermantown, so some of her students are here, and that's kind of freaking her out, too.
Yeah, they're probably really tired of me.
Yeah, they have to listen to her all week, and then they come to church,
the
and
weekend.
They're, who's my teacher?
Yes.
So that's all right. They'll get over it. I wanted to say really, really, really big thank you to the women. We must have had 75 or more women from our community volunteer for our Isn't She Lovely Spa Day today. 370 women came to that event. It was fantastic. Really, really, really amazing. And, you know, lots of women that came for Fruit of the Vine decided to come and join us, and they were in tears over getting a free haircut or a manicure just because they couldn't believe just the generosity and that women would serve them, you know, professionals and just love on them. And so it was amazing. There was quite the height of smells in here about 1 o'clock. It was mostly fingernail polish remover and fingernail polish because I bet we had 100 bottles open at once. So it was kind of like, you know, I almost thought we should give you guys all a little gas mask on the way in, but we've been trying to air it out.
I think it totally smells like a dental office, which is right up there with speaking in public as my greatest fears. And so right now, my blood pressure is
probably way high. If you walk up that aisle right there, on that side, you smell something really dentist-y. Maybe there's a dentist here that just came from work, Jeannie.
I'm sorry if you're a dentist.
I went to the dentist this week, I told him that I was teaching, and he said, you are conquering the two biggest fears in life in 48 hours.
Gosh.
I said, rock on. Does that not count for a discount or something on my crown?
Yeah.
No. He's like, pay the bill. Well, we have been talking for, several weeks now. We've been talking about just characters of the Bible, and we've been doing a series on them, and we just want to see what we can learn from their lives. We want to see, you know, how did they exercise their faith in God, their gifts, how did they respond to God in difficult situations, and just see what we can learn from them. And so Jeannie and I are going to take a look today at two sisters that kind of come in line. We're kind of doing things a little bit chronologically, if you haven't noticed, but we had Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and now we're going to talk about Rachel and Leah. And these are two sisters that had a relationship, and it's all going to be out of Genesis 28 through 30. And there are lots and lots of really timeless truths about these two women and this story and this family and things that we can learn about just how God really longs for us to experience his deep love and acceptance. And as Jeannie and I were talking this week, Jeannie, I thought you had kind of a great story that lays that's just a good foundation for what we're going to talk about some more. And it was about growing up with your dad. And so I want Jeannie to start off by telling us this story about.
All right. As I was kind of reading about Rachel and Leah, I remembered our Sunday morning traditions at my house. My dad had this game called the money game. And what it was, he had all of his change in his pocket from the whole week. And then on Sunday morning, when we're all dressed and ready to go to church, he would have us huddle down at one end of the living room, and he would stand at the other end and start flipping coins toward us. And I had, in my family, five brothers. Well, I had six brothers, but five that were home at the time, and myself, all dressed up in our Sunday best, and my dad would hold up a coin, and then he would start pitching it toward us. Now, he'd start out with, like, the pennies and nickels, and then the dimes, which were really hard to catch, but worth a little more. And we would start pawing over each other and reaching. Now, three of my brothers were tested for something called Marfan syndrome.
Never heard of it.
I know. Well, I think they thought that Abraham Lincoln had it. And the most recognizable symbol is that your arms are really longer than they're supposed to be. So you can imagine.
That's very strange.
It is. Actually, my two sons were tested for it, too.
Sorry, guys.
Sorry, Jake.
That's totally normal.
So when you're trying to reach and grab money and your brothers have like these ape arms going, it causes a lot of friction. So my dad would start pitching and then he would get to the quarters and the half dollars and there'd be like this feverish frenzy going on. And he would hold them up and then start flipping them. So we would be reaching, grabbing, hair would be removed and scratching. And sometimes my dad would start to help one of them. Like he would hold a leg or an arm or he would flip a coin in a certain direction. And I never remember doing anything special with that money. I don't even remember how much I ever got. But what I remember is walking into church with big swollen red eyes, fresh scratches, and a hate for my brothers that no amount of confession could get rid of. And so I thought about that. Now, my dad died when I was 15 years old, and I never really had a chance to, as an adult, say, what were you thinking of, creating this this like sinister game for Sunday mornings? But I think my dad would have said, I was really trying to teach you a lesson. I was trying to teach you about fighting for what you want and to compete. In fact, everything we did was competition. Spitting watermelon seeds was a competition. Picking up rocks in the field was a competition. Husking corn was a competition. And so he made sure that we knew how to compete. And as I look kind of at the world, competition does drive the world. And I love competition. But it has some really long-lasting and some painful consequences that I don't think my dad intended. My brothers and I ended up intact and loving each other. But my father created things that our Father in Heaven really never intended for us to have.
You know, I just thought I should, this is a good place to mention this. When you mention competition, because really it does drive our world, including March Madness brackets. And
Ohio
I'm
lost.
Surprised Chris didn't tell you, but I'm actually a number one and he's a number 15. So.
And I picked Ohio.
And the only reason why I do brackets is to beat Chris. So I'm feeling great, 10 feet tall and bulletproof right now. So anyway, There are things, I think, that happen sort of in life, and they just make it really difficult for us to really experience God's love, kind of like Jeannie's story. You know, maybe her dad was trying to communicate some things, and you know, but we sort of get caught up in wondering, like, how to compensate for not feeling loved sometimes, I think. Or, you know, when we don't feel accepted, we do really crazy things to compensate for that. And eventually, we will turn to other things to get that need met. And one of the things that we see in this story of this family as we've been talking from week to week is some generational sin. And you kind of wonder, you know, you start to see some patterns. You see different things like deception that happened from father to son to, you know, ongoing generations. And, you know, generational sin gets really, really obvious in this family's life, and Jacob's life here. And if you don't know what that means, basically it just means that, you know, there are things that are passed on to us, and you don't necessarily ask for them, but they're just there, and maybe they're even learned from growing up in your home, and, you know, you as well as learning good models, we learn bad models, and so you see, you know, families that struggle with certain addictions, and then that's just kind of passed on from family member to family member, and it's hard to get out of that trap of generational sin. And it really does get in the way of us just being able to receive God's love and his acceptance. And so we're going to look at that a little bit in this story.
Mm-hmm. So as Michael talked about last week, Jacob is on the run. He's kind of in a little money game of his own. His mother and him together had hoodwinked his father Isaac into getting his brother's birthright. Well, Esau is definitely not happy about this, and he decides he's going to take Jacob out. So Rebecca works it so Jacob hits the road and heads back to her brother's house, Laban, which is in Haran. And when Jacob gets there, he only gets as far as the well. And during this time in culture, the well was really this watering hole where sometimes women would go to meet a husband, or it was kind of the sign of the feminine. And when he got there, there were only a couple of shepherds there. And they said that we wait till everybody's here to lift this big stone off, because otherwise the water evaporates, and plus we can't lift it by ourselves. And then Rachel shows up. And instantly, Jacob runs over to her and starts kissing and weeping. Which,
what a mushy guy.
I know. I'm thinking that would not exactly be what
I'm just
what
trying
I'd be
to picture
for.
That, you know, that love at first sight. He starts kissing and weeping.
Yeah. But luckily, he also, you know, besides just the kissing and weeping, he goes over and single-handedly lifts this stone off the well. So he's coming from this generational sin from Sarah and Abraham, from his mother and father, and he is just jumping right into the frying pan.
Yeah, he is. And then it just kind of goes on from there, and we can kind of pick out some other things that get in the way of them being able to receive God's love. Another thing that we see that messes up this family quite a bit, and, you know, their scramble to find love and acceptance, is selfish motives. And, you know, there's everywhere you look, you see selfish motives in the lives of these characters.
Yeah. His uncle, also during this culture, the relationship with your mother's brother, your uncle on your mother's side, is supposed to be so strong that sometimes it's even stronger than the relationship between your father. So when he goes to his uncle Laban, it's really supposed to be somebody he can trust. But it seems, when Jacob has really nothing to offer, he has to start working, and Laban kind of sees dollar signs when he sees what a hard worker Jacob is. And he goes to Jacob and says, well, what can I compensate you with? And instead of money, Jacob asks for Rachel.
How about that girl that I was kissing and weeping over at the well?
Yes, and I'm sure Laban has caught wind
that
Jacob is really taken with his daughter. So Laban says, you can have my daughter if you agree to work 7 years. And in that time also, seven was a sacred number, and the 7 years would be a sacred cycle. So it would really take the place of a dowry that Jacob didn't have. And so he does. He said that if you will work 7 years, you can have my daughter. And he does it, and he makes the agreement. But I don't think he has his daughter's best interest at heart, and I don't think he has Jacob's best interest.
Yeah. And in most people's lives, when things go bad, then they start to blame other people. And we see this too. There's a fair amount of blaming others that starts up. And, you know, that's just one of the things that also kind of gets in the way of us being able to receive God's love and acceptance. And in general, it's just easier when we have pain and hardship in our life. It's really easier if it's somebody else's fault than
it
ours.
Is.
And we try to get others to be the reason why maybe we're not that satisfied. And you know, we might think, well, gosh, if my dad hadn't been so angry, if my mother would have been more nurturing, or if my sister, you know, wasn't, or my brother wasn't so selfish, or, you know, we just get caught in that trap of thinking that our problem is somehow out here, and that it really does keep us from going to God and saying, you know, I need what you have. I need your love and your acceptance. And that's the gift that he wants to deposit in us, that he wants to give us. But our eyes are kind of out here trying to hang our hat on someone else. And we see this in the lives of this family quite a bit. And instead of making it something between, you know, us and God, where we're going to actually depend on him to meet our needs, we really... It's easier to try to get a tangible person to hug us, to love us, to make us feel accepted. And there's just a whole lot of blaming going on in this family at this point.
Yeah, the wedding night comes after 7 years Jacob has worked, and he thinks he's getting Rachel. And in fact, he's tricked into marrying the older sister, Leah. Unlike Rachel, Leah does not seem to be a looker. She's not the one that he would run to and kiss and weep right away. In fact, in the NIV, it says, now Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah had weak eyes, but Rachel was lovely in form and beautiful. The Message, which is another translation, is kind of like a like somebody that wants to hook you up on a blind date or something. Instead of saying she has weak eyes, it says she has nice eyes. You know, Leah, she has nice eyes, but Rachel was stunningly beautiful. In fact, in Hebrew, the name Leah means weary. And I'm sure she was probably weary. She'd been compared to her sister, who was so beautiful. She didn't have anyone asking her to marry her. And it probably was really tiring. I have a sister that was 16 years older than me, and we really didn't have any competition. But I have a brother that's just one grade ahead of me in school, and he was the school computer whiz. He was nerd-alicious, if I have to say that. And back in the day, they had a huge mainframe computer. It was nothing like this. And the teacher, Mr. Timgren, if anything went wrong with the computer, they would call my brother Mark. And Mark would come in out of class. They would take him, call him at home. This huge computer that was down the mysterious math hallway, would my brother would be down there doing things. Well, I had the same teacher for geometry, and he would try to pound geometry theorems into my head to no avail. And I remember him looking at me once and just frazzled, saying, "Wow, your brother is so smart. Why can't you get this?" And I know that weary describes
because I have a different brain.
Yeah, exactly. And my brother looked like Spock, so I figured, okay, so he got Spock. It all worked out. Now, some people might wonder how on earth, I know as a kid I wondered, how could Jacob be tricked into marrying the wrong woman?
No kidding.
Isn't that just crazy? But in that time also, they had these day-long wedding feasts, and you never got to see the bride until the end of the day-long feast, and most of the feasting was really about drinking alcohol. So by nightfall, Jacob was probably extremely drunk, and Leah was probably very much covered except for her nice eyes. That was probably the only thing that he could see. So they have their wedding night. The next morning, Jacob wakes up furious when he looks over and sees who he's married
to. Can you imagine?
No. It sounds so sad. So he goes to his father-in-law.
Sounds like a bad movie.
I know. Or a good movie. And he goes to Laban, just furious, and Laban kind of real nonchalantly said, "I never said you could marry Rachel," the deception. He says, "I did not know." And then he said, "But if you work 7 more years, you can have Rachel." Well, he has to spend a week with Leah, the honeymoon week, and then he gets Rachel, but he still has to work the 7 years, but he can have Rachel in a week. So you can only imagine how Leah feels as she sits there looking at her sister, the woman that her husband really wanted, and her weak eyes are probably filled with some tears.
Yeah, it sounds like a very, very sad. And it's interesting that generational sin pops up here too, because Jacob and his mother fooled Isaac, his father, into giving him the birthright. They had their own deception scheme, and so here we are. Isn't that interesting that now Jacob's being deceived by...
Kind of a boomerang.
Yeah, it's kind of a boomerang. But often we try to meet our own needs for love and acceptance, and I think we all do this to some degree. And Leah wants so badly to be loved. I mean, this woman is empty. She feels unloved, and she's desperate. She goes to some pretty great lengths to, just feel some sense of love and acceptance. Like Jeannie said, she's sitting there looking at Rachel, who's beautiful, knowing that, you know, here she has this husband, but he'd rather be with her sister. And, you know, she's just pretty smart. She's not dumb. And so she knows that her father really pawned her off. And, you know, this guy is not that interested in her, and he'd rather have Rachel. And so there's just this tension going on in the air, and everyone is wanting their own agenda in this story. And so what happens is these characters turn to manipulation because they have to sort this out. They have to get things to work their way. And so there's lots of times, I think, Jeannie, we turn to this even in our own lives, especially, you know, in one thought that comes to me is in parenting. And, you know, sometimes it's hard not to think about your kids and what would be best for them, and then you just start to manipulate their friendships, and you know, you encourage them to invite the right friends over and then buy the best pizza, the ones you don't want them to spend time with, you give them little frozen pizzas, you know. but you do things to try to work behind the scenes, because we want to affect the outcome, we want to change the outcome of their lives. And you know, we think sometimes, gosh, if I can't count the, you know, times that my kids have been in relationships, and I'm like, no, not that one. Yes, that one. You know, it just, oh, I hope none of their girlfriends are here. Sorry, girls. I love them all. But, you know, it's just hard sometimes not to want for your kids what you want, and it maybe doesn't have anything to do with them, or you know, you want them to hang out with the more popular kids, or, you know, you sit there while the teams are getting picked, you know, for sports, and you really want them to get on the team, and you know, if they only had this boy or that girl in their life.
Totally happened to me all the time.
Did it really?
My kids are here. It backfired on me every stinking time. I remember I was at a basketball game, and Jordan was with me, and Jordan's like, "No,
She's grown and married now.
Yes, I had my own kids in school and in sixth grade, and I would tell stories all the time, and I could look at them, and they were just like, ooh,
like
someday.
You were their teacher.
Yeah, I was their teacher.
That's wicked.
So it was hard, so I'm going to tell another story here. But Jordan and I were at a basketball game, and she was in sixth grade. I knew those sixth grade girls. I knew which ones were the good kids, the popular kids, and I knew which ones I wanted her to hang out with. So we were sitting there, and she was sitting right next to me when all of these really popular girls came in. And I, right away, my little antenna went up, and I'm like, oh, here's those popular girls. But then they sat down below, and Jordan kind of squished a little bit closer to me. And I thought, aw, they're not going to invite her to sit with them. And then one of them turned around, and shazam, they invited her to sit with them. And I was like,
you're so excited.
I was so excited. In my head, I had all these things planned. Number one, she was going to get invited to sleepovers. Number two, they were going to wear matching Zubas to the dances. Number three, they were going to be homecoming royalty someday together.
This is all going through your head in this moment in the basketball game.
Really fast. Because awesome. It had been there before already. But so Jordan looks at them and me, and she said, no, I'm going to sit by my mom. I could have twanged her. Like, what? And she said she had her reasons. Well, I until about maybe 4 or 5 years later, I couldn't see those reasons. And then I did. And I realized it was this empty well in me that I was trying to fill with Jordan. Mm. And that she had wisdom beyond her years, even in when she was 12 years old, and it took her to tell me. But did it stop me from doing it? No. I continued to do those things, and we don't know if Laban had Leah's best interest. We didn't know if he was trying to look out for her, if he was just trying to get 7 more years out of Jacob, but we do know that it has the first victim of manipulation.
And Leah and Rachel both get really caught up in trying to earn love as well. So we get deeper into this story, and we find out that, you know, God really does have a lot of mercy and grace for Leah, and yet she is going to turn to trying to get love and not really just receiving it from God again, not receiving it by grace, but what is she going to do to try to make herself be loved and earn that from especially Jacob? And you know, God sees her, he notices her, he sees her need. But boy, she's already on a roll.
Yeah. Leah has got to be hurting. And in Genesis 29, it says that 29:31, it said that God realized that Leah was unloved. He opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. It's kind of like he's taking sides a little bit there. But Leah starts to have children. So she has her first son, and she names him Reuben. In the Hebrew, Reuben means it's a boy. Or it's a son. And you can almost see Leah just jumping up in the back of the room, waving her hands like, I did it, I gave you a son. In fact, she says, this is a sign that God has seen my misery, and now my husband will love me. Hmm. Which kind of breaks your heart because it didn't happen. Then she has her second son, which is Simeon. And that name means God heard. And she says, God heard that I was unloved, and so he gave me this son also. Which continues to break your heart. And then she has Levi. And that name in the Hebrew means to connect. And she says, now maybe my husband will connect with me. I've given him 3 sons. And she has another son named Judah. And it means praise God. And she said, this time I'll praise God. Which gives me a little hope for Leah. When I read those, I think all the time, we are trying to please people, trying to earn love. And I remember my husband's family, when his dad was alive, he was one of those men that never let his sons know that he loved them. He never gave them any signs of approval. He never made them feel like he thought they were good sons. And they would do cartwheels and somersaults in front of him, just like, Dad, notice me. Notice that I got a good job. Notice that I shot a deer. Anything, just notice me. He never did. And I feel like that's Leah, just trying to get Jacob to love her.
And even these names that she comes up with and gives her son, I mean, it just speaks to this huge emptiness that she has and this desire that she has to earn love from her husband. And then with her fourth son, there's just this little glimmer of hope. Maybe she's seeing here. She's starting to find her hope in God. And, you know, this plan that these women are absolutely consumed with is about people-pleasing. They are incredibly caught up, and there's a great deal of codependency. And that's also just another one of the things that we do and get caught up in. I mean, how many of us have, at some point in our life, we've kind of gotten in that trap of needing to please people? I prayed with someone last week that just said, I cannot please my mom, but I think God's telling me that I'm not supposed to be trying to please my mom. And it's kind of a revelation when we get out from under those expectations, whether they're spoken or unspoken expectation, because we lose ourselves in trying to please somebody else. And I think this picture is just, again, like you said, Jeannie, it's heartbreaking, because Leah wants Jacob to love her so desperately that she absolutely gives away. She loses who God created her to be out of that desperation. And she takes things in her own hands. And so here's a couple ways that we see these women respond. They respond by competing for their own desired income, because by golly, they do have an agenda. And so they have a plan, and they're going to work it.
Yeah. And so this whole time, Rachel can't have any children. She might have the man, but she can't seem to have any children. When I was a kid, I used to feel sorry for her because I felt like she was set to marry the man of her dreams, and then this older, bossy sister just kind of swooped in, took him away from her. But the more I read about it, I'm not totally sure. I'm sure she was hurt by her father manipulating things, and she was probably sick of these little snot-nosed nephews running around reminding her that she couldn't have children. But instead of making lemonade, she sort of takes a different route. And Rachel goes to her husband and says, give me children or I will die. And I don't know about you, but that's probably not the best way to go about it, but she does. She wants a son so badly that she goes to her husband and just desperately cries out. Now, I think Jacob could have taken one of two routes here. He could have put his arms around her and told her, you know what, it doesn't matter. I still love you. It doesn't matter, but he didn't.
No.
He kind of really took the low road here. And he says to her, am I God? Am I the one who refused you babies? If that were my husband, I would clobber him.
I'd get out the gun.
Like, over there. It's not exactly what you want to hear when you're desperate and you're hurting. I'm sure by this time, Rachel sounds like, you know, fingernails going down the chalkboard because she's wanted these children for so long. But it's still. And Jacob knows it's not his problem. If there's a problem, it's with Rachel. He has four boys, and he's doing just fine in the fertility department. Yeah. And so the problem has to be on Rachel's end, and that has to even hurt her even more than already.
Yeah, and that comparing that's going on between her and her sister. And Rachel is just so desperate that she decides that she's going to take things in her own hands. And so she starts to respond by refusing to wait for God's timing. And I think this is something else that kind of creeps into our lives as well. When we get desperate, we take things in our own hands. You know, sometimes it's like we don't want to wait to find out what God's plan is. And I think it might be one of the most depraved parts of our culture because we hate to wait. We hate to wait for anything. And we sort of get just totally, I think it's a false belief, but we believe that somehow that our happiness, our internal happiness, really depends on us getting what we want. Mm-hmm. And we want what we want. And so we refuse to wait for God's timing. And boy, Rachel, this gets worse.
Yeah, it does. It kind of spirals down even further. You know, today, when you can't, Rachel wants a baby. She wants a baby desperately. And that's true today. There are many more options today, though. And she only has really one option, and that's her maidservant. And she looks at her, and probably like that light bulb went off in my head when I saw those girls in the middle school that I thought would be perfect friends for Jordan. The same thing happens to Rachel when she looks at her maidservant, Bilha. Like, she's my property. If she had children, they would be my children. And so she gives her maidservant to her husband, and sure enough, her maidservant, Bilha, has two sons. Rachel names the son. The first one is named Dan, which means judge or vindication. And then Rachel says, God took my side. And the second son that Bilha has is Naphtali. And this name means wrestling or fight. And she also says, I have been in an all-out fight with my sister, and I have won.
Yeah, and I mean, I can only imagine just how the fact that she took those names and named those kids what she named them just really gives us this honest look at her heart and, you know, what's going on in her heart and her mind. And she is in all-out war at this point with her sister, and she wants God to be the referee. And she seems to have this constant wrestling match going on in her mind. And, you know, I see that a lot of just insecurity and inadequacy in her. And, you know, the relationship with both of these women just gets completely marked by competition and pain of comparing themselves and their children. They're very jealous. I think jealousy has kind of come in and really consumed their lives. And they're pretty controlled by their jealousy. And it makes them do crazy things. And they're just incredibly insecure and unsettled. And, you know, I think that that's not that far off from some of the scenario that's going on in some of us, too. And, you know, I know that there's probably people here that have siblings that, you know, you've been trying to keep up with them. I used to have I have a friend. She moved away right now, but in another country. But I remember just her just crying, and we'd pray over just how she felt her parents had this expectation that her siblings were matching up to, but she wasn't. And she always knew it. She always felt that. She was letting them down. She was disappointing. She just felt like my life and what I'm doing, and you know, wasn't even that she was doing anything bad or bad choices, but it just wasn't what they wanted. It didn't fit the profile that they had planned for her, and she didn't measure up. And that's really, I think, incredibly mm-hmm. painful for people.
Mm-hmm. I've never been in the same spot as Rachel, but I know I've tried to make things happen. I'll ask God for it, and then before I even give God a chance, mm-hmm. I just jump in and try to make it happen. And I always mess things up. Sometimes I'll even get a reasonable facsimile of what I want, mm-hmm. but it's never as good as what God had for me. And Rachel does the same thing. She gets these two surrogate sons, and it never talks about her loving them. It never talks about her being tender towards them. It almost seems like they're just notches in her belt, and she doesn't get what she dreamed of. She still wants more.
Yeah, they do. And both Leah and Rachel are missing something here. They're missing God's blessings to them. And, you know, God is giving them children, and he's meeting a lot of their needs. But they're just so consumed with this race to win their husband's affection, and it's all through giving him children. And, you know, so not to be outdone, Leah seems to have this dry spell for a while. She looks at her sister, she's like, doggone it, she's having these babies through her, I think of it sort of as a nanny. You know, you have to think about this for a minute. Imagine being in a race, might be hard for some of you men, but, you know, give it a try. A race of producing babies that is so competitive that you would go to the place of having your nanny sleep with your husband so that she could bear children for him, because you can't keep up with, you know, his wife, one of his wives, your sister. I mean, that's just, I'm like trying to wrap my mind around that, and it's, you know, sketchy. But the sons are named, and their names tell us even a little bit more about the desperation that's going to go on in this woman. And Leah has two sons, and one of them is called Gad, and that means good fortune. And she says, like, when she names him, what good fortune? You know, she's thinking about how now Jacob will respond to me and how, you know, she's going to benefit from that. And then the second son she names Asher, which means happy. And she actually says, when she names Asher, she says, how happy I am. The women will call me happy. So again, you know, like, you're having these children, and it's all about, you know, now I'm going to look good to other people. Now I'm going to look better to my husband, who I'm trying to win his affections. And so around this time, Reuben is out in the field. Reuben, remember, is one of Leah's son, her oldest son. He's out in the field. He's coming home out of the field, and he comes carrying this big basket of mandrake plants. Now, in ancient cultures, a mandrake plant were thought to be an aphrodisiac, or a fertility plant, sort of like the fertility drug of the day. And so if you're trying to beat your sister at having babies, this is a jackpot, you know? You see him coming, and you're like, I want some mandrake, you know? And so Rachel sees this, and she wants this mandrake, and so she asks Leah. I mean, it's kind of like a begging, pleading thing. You know, please give me some of your son's mandrakes. So tell us what happens from
there. Well, often God will give us this chance for reconciliation. And Rachel goes to Leah, and just you see this little chink in her armor that at this point, there is an opportunity for a truce between them. Yeah. Because I think Leah can look at Rachel and just go, oh man, she is hurting just as much as I'm hurting. Yeah. And they have an opportunity to be real sisters. But snap, Leah doesn't take it. Instead, she snaps back at her sister and said, wasn't it enough that you took away my husband? Will you take my son's mandrakes too? And I'm thinking, who took whose husband? But somehow Leah is completely convinced that Rachel stole her husband. Well, Rachel cuts a deal. In return for the fertility drug, she's going to allow her sister Leah to sleep with her husband Jacob, which happens to be Leah's husband too.
There's a lot of sleeping with a lot of different people in this.
Yeah, so Jacob comes
in. It's like he can hardly keep up with it.
Yeah, he comes in from the field. He's probably exhausted. And there is Leah waiting at the gate. And Leah says to him, you have to sleep with me. I have hired you with my son's mandrakes. Now, I don't know if that's the most romantic segue
ever. Try
that
pickup line.
So I'm sure at this point, Jacob is either completely exhausted or thinking he is jackpot city. But sure enough, Leah gives birth to her fifth and sixth son. She has Zebulun, which means honor. And she says, God has presented me with a precious gift. This time, my husband will treat me with honor because I have borne him six sons. And then she, first one was Issachar, and that one means bartered. God has rewarded me for giving my maidservant to my husband. And then she has Zebulun, which means honor. And she said, this time my husband will honor me. And then she does have a daughter, and there's a whole other story about her talking about generational sin that goes on.
And that's Dinah.
Yeah, and that goes on.
And it kind of seems like, here's the thing, it seems like Leah and Rachel are, it is so consumed with this competition and jealousy that they're forgetting something. And, you know, like saying thank you to the Lord. You know, and they, you see God, and they're even acknowledging that God's given them these children, but then they derive their own meaning from it. And I think sometimes that we forget to say thank you for the blessings that God's given us. He's so faithful. And even when we're messing up a lot and making bad choices, he is so faithful. And, you know, Rachel gets what she wants here, but she's not satisfied yet. It's just, it isn't enough. And that dissatisfaction just continues to kind of eat away at her and make her continue to be manipulative, desperate, and coercive. And she's not done yet.
She gets the mandrakes. They don't do the trick. But later, it says that God listened to her and opened her womb. And sure enough, Rachel has a son. She has a son named Joseph. And she names him Joseph, which means add. And she says, God has taken away my disgrace. May the Lord add to me another son. And I think to myself, she hasn't even really watched her little boy crack a smile, and she's already on to the next. Yeah. And that next one about focusing on the next prize. And how many times do we do that? Where we have, you know, been praying for something and praying for something, and then it happens, and we're already on to the next thing that we're praying for. And this is Rachel. Laban, you know, she's prayed and prayed, and she gets exactly what she wants. Yeah. Well, now Laban's scheming has finally come to the end of it, and Jacob is tired of it. He's tired of his father-in-law, and so he packs everybody up, and they head out. And on the way back to Bethel, Rachel gives birth to another son. And this son, earlier when she said, give me children or I'll die, now that prophecy comes true. She has a son, and she names him Ben-Oni, which means son of my pain, and then she dies. And she kind of dies just on the side of the road as they're moving along. And then Jacob changes the son's name to Benjamin, which means son of good fortune. Not exactly sure.
He waits till she dies, changes the name of the kid.
To son of good fortune. Not sure if that's really good, but he buries her alongside of the road, and then he puts up some pillars as a kind of an altar to her or kind of a remembrance to her, and they keep moving. Now, you have to wonder at this point, if Leah even mourns her sister's death, if she is secretly pleased about it, did she think she had wasted all those years, no. that she could have had a sister and they could have had a relationship together? So Rachel dies, she's buried, they move on, and as time goes on, Leah dies, and she ends up being buried in the place of honor next to her husband. Now, in this race to win, I just think of how many blessings these two women completely missed and completely lost. Growing up, my dad had 7 brothers, and 2 of them were very close until something happened when they were in about their 30s or 40s, and it was just this really minor thing that had happened, but it completely severed their relationship. And from then on, every family reunion, every Christmas, every holiday, they would sit on separate sides, their families separated, there would be fist fights, there would be hollering and screaming. It just became this horrible, ugly thing. Well, one of my uncles, Kenny, died when he was 55 unexpectedly of a heart attack. He was the one that Edward and Kenny were fighting. And I remember at Kenny's funeral that Edward walked up to the casket and I watched him stand there and look at his brother. And I just kept thinking, was it really worth it? Was it really worth 15 years of not talking to each other? And I really felt like that's what these two sisters. Did Leah think it was worth it?
Yeah. And, you know, I think, this is a sad story. Mm-hmm. It's a sad story. And it's hard to kind of wrap your mind around that intense jealousy and that competition and how consuming it was. But here's the thing. We see some amazing things come from this family and this family's lineage over generations. Like even in the midst of all of that junk and all of that competition and that sin against each other, God brought the Savior of the world through the lineage of Leah, through her son Judah. And, there's other things that we see too. There's a couple other things in the lineage.
Well, from Levi came all of the priests of the tribe of Israel. And then Joseph, who ended up in Egypt, preserved the 12 tribes of Israel when he went there and made provisions for him. So there were some amazing things that came from those 12 sons.
Yeah, and just what we see in this story from this family is that, you know, in the end, God gets the final word. He gets the final word of what happens. And then he redeems. He redeems everything through it all for all of his purposes. And I find that to be the hope of this story. I find that to be, something that I can look at. And in the midst of, you know, just pain and suffering and division in families, God's still God. And he still does what he does when we turn to him and when we submit to him and when we obey him. We see him come and redeem. We see him come and redeem everything. And all of these women's mistakes are redeemed, you know, for generations through the lineage of their sons. It's just it's really an amazing, amazing story of how God redeems our mistakes. Why don't you guys stand up with us, if you will? We're going to pray. We always like to just take a few minutes just to kind of reflect on and respond to some of the things that God might be saying to us individually or just highlighting to us in the moment. And I know that there's stuff, as we were praying this week and preparing for this, I know that there are things in the lives of these Bible characters that we relate to because they're in our lives too. And we just want to pray and ask the Holy Spirit to come. And one of the things we want to do is just give God a chance to touch some of those places in our lives that he's just waiting and wanting to do. And so, Father, would you just release your Spirit right now even more? God, I thank you so much for the story of the kingdom of God and how you're always pursuing relationship with us. And God, I thank you for the great lengths that you go to love us, to accept us. And God, would you help us just kind of stop and make a decision, decide to get that love and that acceptance from you. God, I look at all the external things and how they just didn't, it just doesn't pan out. It doesn't work. It didn't work years ago, ancient times, and it doesn't work today either. Doesn't work to try to earn love or manipulate for it, God. Doesn't work to blame others because we don't feel loved. But you're just calling us to yourself right now. You're just calling us, God, just to come and receive. And the Lord's just going to begin to pour out his heart on us tonight. And we don't have anything better to do than to stand in his presence right now and just receive his love. God, some of us are so desperate for this love and acceptance. And we just take that list of things that, you know, if I had this, if I had another child, if I could, then I'd be happy, then I'd be loved, then I'd be accepted. We just kind of want to hand that list over to you right now, Father. Would you take our eyes off of all those external things? God, we just stand humbly before you and we say, come, Lord. Just come, Lord, and pour out your spirit. Pour out your love. Pour out your acceptance.
God, as I prepared for this lesson over the week and the weeks before, I just kept getting the word reconciliation. That there are so many people that have severed relationships with family members, and that God really wants those to be made whole again. So, Father, I just ask that you would come into the hearts of those people that have broken relationships, yes, and you would start to really speak to them and just move, and your Holy Spirit would come and start to redeem those relationships.
And the truth is, you don't know if your family's going to respond or not to that, but you can start with you. And so if our ministry team could come up right now, they're just trained to just pray for and bless what God's doing in you. I feel that some of you that have this division in your family, that you would just come up and you would just say, yeah, I don't want any part of this jealousy. I don't want any part of this competition. And that we could just break off some of the expectations, false expectations, maybe a family that have tried to get you to measure up. Have some small group leaders and a few more people to pray, that'd be great. And we're just going to worship, and you know, I really trust that you're not doing anything for me or Jeannie or responding to us, but you're just responding to what God's doing in you. But family division, God wants you to leave it here and say, God, start with me. Start patching things up with me. And then there's also some people that it's been hard to say thank you to the Lord. You're kind of barreling through life, and you can, if you just stop, you can see that, yeah, he's here for me, he's faithful, but I haven't stopped to say thank you and be grateful for that. And you know, we kind of want more. We want that healing when we've had partial healing, or we kind of are on to the next prize, the next thing that we want God to do for us, but we need to stop and say thank you for what you've done for me. And we just want to bless that too and pray with you. We would love to do that. And so all you gotta do is just anytime during the next song or two, just come on up, and these people would love to just bless what God's doing. Don't leave the same as when you came. Bless you guys.